Hi, this is Dr. Tom Rogers coming to you with the weekly podcast of the Common Sense MD. Today I've got a special treat. It's somebody as a guest I've wanted to be on here for the last 3 years, and I finally got him. He agreed to come on here. It's Dr. Jim Brantner. He's a plastic surgeon extraordinaire, and really I'm so honored to have you here. It's like a dream come true because my admiration for you is really off the charts for a lot of reasons, not only because you're a great surgeon, but because of just the person you are and the way you think. Well, we talk a lot about aging, and we talk a lot about what's happened to our medical society, and, you know, the way things have changed. My dad was a surgeon who I think you knew my surgeon brother, and it's amazing to me that you're 79 years old.
Almost.
And you're at the peak of your career. You're fit. I mean, you're the example of longevity. My practice is really geared towards helping people live longer and better. And you're just the epitome of that. You know, we've known each other for years, and every time I see you, you look better. You look fit. You're still playing golf and walking the golf course. You play 36 holes some days. You're still hitting them long and far, and maybe not as straight.
Well, not nearly as far as I'd like to.
But Dr. Jim Brantner, thank you so much for coming on here today. We got so much to talk about. And I want to get into kind of what you like to do, maybe some of the pitfalls of plastic surgery and your special interest. You've been a real innovator with a lot of procedures. And again, Dr. Brantner, you went to West Point. You kind of worked your way up, and then you served in Vietnam. You Yes. served in the military for 24 years, and you've been in private practice for a long time. And you're kind
That's
of the
correct.
When I think of a plastic surgeon who knows what they're doing, and it's just you're the epitome to me of a physician and also a surgeon. And so, anyway, enough of the admiration. Mm-hmm. Let's get down to talking about. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about kind of your journey, what you like to do now. At this point in your life, you should be able to do anything you want to do. What are your passions, and kind of how did you get here?
Well, I appreciate all your comments. This is delusions of grandeur, but I was out in the real Army for several years, and then God kind of led me into plastic surgery. I had no clue that I wanted to do that. I had, when I was younger, been into sports and thought I'd be an orthopedist and do sports medicine, and God said no, and I ended up in plastic surgery, and I love it. One of the things that has been an absolute godsend for me is that spending all that time out in the Army in combat situations and whatever, I lost my fear of not buying what the graybeards told me. And I would tell the younger guys, I've got gray hair now, you don't believe what I tell you either. You gotta think. And I've had a number of experiences with procedures, like when I first got to Walter Reed, I saw two ladies die after tummy tucks from throwing blood clots to their lungs. It's called a pulmonary embolus. And I never did it because I thought the protocol was stupid. The protocol was that we laid these ladies flat on their back in bed for 5 days with sandbags on their abdomen. And we got into a big kind of a knockdown, drag out fight in a department meeting one day, and our chief, who actually loved it if anybody disagreed with him, but we had a patient that had been done just a couple days before, and he was up and he said, "When did you get her out of bed anyway?" And I said, "In the recovery room." And he said, "Why'd you do anything so stupid?" And I said, "'Cause I hate it when my patients die from PEs." And he said, "How long you been doing it?" And I said, "About 6 months." "Have you seen any problems?" I said, "No." He said, "Oh, maybe it's a good idea. We changed the protocol." The other one we did, and this is my, I guess, leading into what you just said, Tom, is probably my number one procedure that I really love is a breast reduction. When I got to Walter Reed again, the average blood loss was about 400 to 600 cc's in a breast reduction. And to put that in perspective for people that don't know this, when you give blood, you give 500 cc's. So 400 or 500 cc blood loss, a lot of blood. We'd get each of our patients to go to the blood bank and give a unit of blood a month before the procedure, and then we'd give it back to them in the operating room. And by that time, their body had replaced a lot of it, so we were kind of ahead of the curve. And I said, yeah, okay, how did God design the system? Well, we did adrenaline and local anesthetics for a lot of things, like little stuff on the face that might bleed a lot, and it constricted blood vessels. I went to the literature, and I did a very extensive literature search, and nobody had ever documented what adrenaline did either in blood vessel, in muscle, or in nobody had ever documented what they did in breast tissue or fat, which is primarily what you're dealing with in the breast.
Sure.
So my thought was, okay, when God designed the system, he designed it so that in the fight or flight response, the blood vessels in your brain and your muscle dilate, and the vessels everywhere else constrict because you don't need them.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I think this ought to work. So I hate to get into some of this physiology stuff, but I designed a prospective double-blind study with 40 patients. Now, what that means is that I didn't know what I was giving the patients. We gave each patient was their own control. One side was done with solution A, the other was solution B, and the pharmacy had the code. Mm-hmm. We didn't know what we were putting in. Generally, statistical significance is determined at the 5% level. So if you flip a coin 100 times and you get 90 heads, you say, yeah, that can happen. If you get 96 heads, you figure there's something wrong with the coin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I broke the code after 10 patients because it was unethical to continue. I would lose 300 cc's on one side and 25 on the other. And I had significance after 10 patients at the 1% level. That basically, I don't know of any plastic surgeon in the country that doesn't use adrenaline in their local anesthetics for breast reductions now. So that's kind of the start. You know, that gave me a good attitude about them.
You kind of pioneered that. That's amazing.
But, and basically, yeah, I mean, my... I don't know if I pioneer that, but I guess that and $4 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks. But
everybody uses epinephrine for any procedure like that.
Well, when I did that,
or whatever.
When I did that, it had never been documented with any of this stuff. So anyway, I obviously had a warm spot in my heart for breast reductions after that, and. It's an operation that's unusual. When you get into most surgery, and I can tell you my mother-in-law, who's just about to turn 92, fell about 3 weeks ago. She broke her pelvis. She broke her shoulder. And she's been in the hospital, and this is a big deal. It kind of illustrated something because in most surgical procedures, you're better off before you ever get the procedure than you were afterwards. In other words, if you have an injury like that, if you're in a car accident, you get surgery and you can be really grateful that you've survived it, that you've gotten the injuries fixed, and so on and so forth. With a breast reduction, it's kind of a unique, and a lot of plastic surgeries like this, but the breast reduction is probably the poster child. Somebody comes into the operating room and they don't have a significant problem with their breasts. what their problem is their back pain kills them. They can't do anything. They're limited in their activities. They're limited all kinds of ways, and not to mention just how it looks. And after a reduction, they not only look better, but they feel better. I did a reduction here a couple weeks ago where I took about 5 pounds of breast tissue off a lady. The torque effect of that, where the breast is hanging down and pulling on the back, is about 7 to 1. So basically, I took a 35-pound pack off her back. And they walk in, these ladies come in their preoperative state, and they've got their shoulders hunched because they can't stand up straight. They come in the next day, they don't even think about it. They're just standing up straight and walking normally, and they don't think about it. It just happens. And it's immediate. I mean, they tell me their back feels better in the recovery room. And I have patients that come in 10 years later, tell me it's the best thing they ever did. I have patients that have had complications, and there's no operation that doesn't have those. I ask them, and they say they would do it again in a heartbeat. It didn't matter. The result was worth going through the problems.
Aren't there many more breast reductions and enhancements performed?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say?
I probably do 3 to 1.
As a plastic surgeon, that's got to give you a lot of gratification, even more so probably than doing a facelift or a cosmetic procedure for beauty. Does it give you a little more gratitude to really fix somebody's problem like that that's been suffering physically for years maybe? I mean, I'm sure it's gratifying both ways because beauty is confidence and affects you in every way. But, you know, in the plastic surgeons that I've known, they really like helping somebody out that has a deformity or that kind of thing, even more so than making an already beautiful woman even prettier. You do both, but...
And you bring up something that is kind of how I've run my office, and that is that, and I tell people this, you know, they say, how much does this cost? I don't know. When I retired from the Army, I decided I wasn't going to change how I practiced based on money. I'm here to help people. I'm not here to, you know, keep my accountant happy. We get reviews all the time where people will say they feel like they're part of a family when they come in. We have people that will come in 3 months and 6 months later and bring us a cake or something like that, and we haven't seen them. They just say they missed us. And so my whole goal, and you just hit it right on the nose, because when I can help somebody have a better life, then that's far more gratifying than anything that you can put in the bank.
That's exactly right. I mean, and you truly, I've watched you through the years, and that's exactly what you do. And that's the reason that you're doing this at age 78, going on 79 years old, and or so. It's attitude. You know, it's the reason you're doing this. If you're doing it for the money, you'd have been burnt out, retired, and you'd be doing something else. But
truly
love what you do, and you're very good at it. You have gifting, and, you know, you rely on God to guide you. I know that because we've talked a lot about spirituality. But so you really like the breast reductions. And anything else in plastic surgery that you think has changed? What advice would you give? A few tips on maybe what to do and maybe what to avoid with plastic surgery.
I don't know. You may not like this one. Okay. When somebody has lost tremendous amounts of weight, you know, 100, 150 pounds, 200 pounds, frequently they have a very large abdominal overhang.
Oh, yeah.
And when it hangs low enough, it becomes a low back problem. Insurance companies will pay for it, and it's a massive operation. And
paniculectomy, is that what you're...
Paniculectomy.
I'm all for it, believe me.
But I've been doing these for 40 years, and every once in a while you see a problem. In the last 3 years, we have started counseling people that it's an unusual paniculectomy that doesn't have a problem. And it's all...
I've seen that.
It's the microemboli that are caused by the COVID shots. And I've had the folks running a COVID unit tell me, oh yeah, that's the COVID shot, it does that. I thought I've gotten to the point where a year or so ago, 6 months ago, I was really starting to worry about my technique. What am I doing? Why am I doing this? And then I've talked to some folks that I know in a major, major size practice in Charlotte. I've talked to some others elsewhere, and they tell me they're seeing the same thing.
Very interesting. You know, I have to be careful on these podcasts what I say, because
me too.
As you know, I've been censored for three or four times, been kicked off of some of these platforms because I've spoken my mind. Censorship is a real thing these days. But I agree with you. I've seen a lot of stuff from it also. You know, I saw bad things happen from COVID, and I saw other bad things happen from the jab. So I'm with you 100% because I end up seeing a lot of the injuries that, you know, we have to deal with. And there are ways to kind of bring you out of the danger zone from that we do here at the office every day. But that's a really interesting comment, and I believe you 100%.
I mean, this is like, I think I have three patients right now that I've done within the last month that are still in wound care. And getting major wound care because wounds have fallen apart and they've done things that I've never seen before.
Yeah, you know, we've seen a lot of autoimmune diseases that are kicked off by probably the jab, and, you know, I've seen a lot of type 1 diabetes appear shortly after it, the jab, and in adults who you wouldn't think would get type 1, used to be called juvenile diabetes, but I've seen several of those, and certainly can exacerbate previous existing viral infections as well as kick off other autoimmune diseases that we see and deal with here every day. But that really brings up a great lead in to kind of, I want to talk a little bit about the way medicine's headed. Again, the longer I've practiced, the more I kind of don't trust certain things that I've thought all along or that the experts will tell me. And, you know, I try to, like you say, use your brain instead of what somebody else tells you. That's why I call myself the Common Sense MD. Yeah. Because obvious.
You are. I've known you for a long time, and you are. And the thing is that, and I understand that there's a lot of political pressure with some of this, but some of the stuff that we see now are things we've never seen before. I got my first introduction to the effects of COVID and the COVID shots probably three and a half years ago when I had a patient I had done a breast reduction on, and she came in 3 months out, completely healed, back to full normal activities, with two nickel-sized areas on the underside of her breast on each side. I should have picked up on the fact that it was symmetrical, so that it was a systemic problem, but I didn't. So I cleaned it up, sent her to wound care on a Wednesday afternoon. They called me Thursday and said, "We can't do anything with this, it's all dead." And I said, "Send her back here." So they sent her back to my office. The whole bottom half of each breast was dead. And when I put her in at Franklin Woods, the guy that ran the COVID unit said, "Oh yeah, that's the blood clotting from COVID." I mean, just matter-of-factly. And I've seen a tremendous amount of that stuff. When you look at things like the athletes, my number one favorite example is that Europe has been keeping track of deaths from athletes, and these are professional athletes, you know, super jocks in their 20s and 30s, and they average, this is over the entire continent of Europe, they average two or three a year. In 21, there were 490. Wow. And it's almost every one of them that get autopsies, it's the blood vessel and the heart inflammation. And then when you start looking at, you know, where the money goes, like, you know, the drug companies and the CDC and whatever, they've been burying data, and you're starting to see some of it coming out in Freedom of Information Acts. They're coming out with data that they've been hiding for 3 years, and it's scary.
Very scary. You know, we see it all the time, and it's hard to, I think the medical community's lost a lot of credibility because of what's happened in the last 4 years. I really do. I see it every day. And, you know, talking about common sense, I don't know, and even though they're still pushing the jab, I don't know many people that are actually taking them anymore, but maybe 8-10%, even though they're still pushing it, because people have common sense. Yeah. They've seen that it doesn't work. No,
you're absolutely right. And one of the things I've noticed, and I've commented on this to patients and other doctors and whatever, is 3 years ago, virtually everybody that came in the office had that jab. Now, I would say 1 out of 10 maybe, or there are some that have had it in the past and said, yeah, I had 2 of them, you know, like 2 years ago, but I wouldn't get another one, or they've never done it or whatever. And
or they regret it.
Every year they got it and they're regretting it. How do I reverse this stuff? And I think the word's getting out.
Yeah, people are kind of waking up to the fact that it wasn't that great, like they claimed. I mean, that wasn't the cure for COVID.
No.
I mean, when they say it, we finally had that, and that's the cure for COVID, believe me, that wasn't the cure for COVID.
I actually saw a study once several months ago where they said that if you got your first COVID shot, the risk of getting COVID dropped by 60%. After the second shot, your risk of COVID dropped by 40%. With the first booster, you were dead even. With the second booster, your risk of getting COVID went up 40%. Mm-hmm. And they're still pushing that stuff.
I'm seeing the same thing. And really, you know, COVID these days is like a mild cold. Yeah. I treated a case yesterday. Right. I treat it every day. And, you know, a lot of times, number one, it's hard to trust the testing for it. But, I mean, it's very mild. It's mutated so much. And really, it's stayed... It stayed around because of those mutations.
Well, I we're getting off, I guess, plastic surgery, but I was at a Reawaken conference in Nashville a little over a year ago. And there's a new speaker every 15 minutes for 2 days with no breaks. It's multiple subjects, but there were 3 doctors that did not know each other, had no connection with each other, but they had stopped their practice when the COVID first hit, and they did nothing but treat COVID patients for free with the Zelenko protocol, which most medical groups and whatever absolutely abhor. They had 21,000 patients between the 3 of them. No deaths, no hospitalizations.
I believe it 100%. You know, there's no doubt that there was ways to treat it that they were suppressing and all, but again, we got to be careful what we say because this will never get out.
That's true.
But so we better get back on the subject. But I love to talk about this, you know. But again, you got to be really careful about it because really, it's so divisive too. What I've found amazing is that it's so polarizing. Even not only within the medical community, but also within families. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Absolutely. We've seen that in our family, a lot of medical folks in the family, and it's just, and we can't get through. Goebbels, who was the propaganda minister for Hitler, had a famous quote that if you tell the big lie often enough, people believe you. We've heard it.
That's a very good point. So let me ask you, in your life, I mean, you're going to be 79 years old. How have you stayed in such good shape to keep this up? I mean, you're a guy that's probably going to live to about 115, because I do think people are going to live a lot longer now. But what advice would you give to people as far as what works for longevity, not just beauty, but feeling good, staying healthy, been able to ruck or hit a golf ball or play tennis, or what advice would you give them in their lifetime so that they'll live a longer, better life?
I'm not entirely sure how to answer that, but I think for me personally, it's never slow down. You know, you find what you like to do and you keep doing it and you don't stop. The example of this comes from military, really, because a lot of people retire from the military in their mid late 40s, and they go sit on their chair in a their rocking chair on the porch with a beer in their hand, and they die in their 50s. Mm-hmm. To me, I found something that I really love doing. We have a big family that keeps us going. I have 7 kids.
And you got a great family. I know them.
And
amazing people.
You just keep going all the time. And I think that the answer to that question is don't ever slow down. Just
and
keep going
and keep
a doing
positive attitude.
Keep
maybe.
A positive attitude. And then just, you know, God will take care of the rest.
Yep. Yep. Along with eating right, exercise.
Yeah.
You're out there every day. You know, you look at hormone levels. You do everything right. You know, when I read a lot and I follow a lot of longevity doctors, and you're one of those that just is living it. You know, you really are. I mean, it's just incredible that, you know, I consider myself senior at 69 years old, and you're almost 10 years older than me, and you just look great. Your attitude's great. You're active. You do anything you want. And it's just admirable.
Well,
you know,
thank you.
Your practice just keeps getting better and better. I mean, how many surgeons that you train with are still practicing? You know any? Any of them?
Not many. I think that the ones that I started off with way a long time ago know. There are some that I've seen a couple of them that when we first came to town more than 30 years ago, they were going strong and fairly early on in their careers, and they've retired. And I said, if I retire, what would I do?
Yeah.
Like, I've got better things to do than just sit.
I agree. You retire, that's the first step in dying, I think. Unless you have something else that you're really passionate about.
Yeah.
You know, you obviously are doing this for the right reasons. And, you know, kudos to you for the life you live and all these people you help. You know, really, in our profession, it's really to help other people.
That's exactly right.
And our medical machine has really, and it's not the doctor's fault, it's the system's fault that it's turned it into such a, you know, money, greedy, pharmaceutical, insurance-based model that the doctor is really caught in a place where it's hard to practice medicine in the right way.
And that's why I stay in a solo practice, is I don't have any medical system telling me how to practice.
That's why I went solo 18 years ago. I watched my dad have a 40-year career as a surgeon solo.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. I think it's the best way to go because you don't get caught up in the corporate machinery of everything else. And when you do that, it's all about documentation, coding, and collections, and which copay, which insurance. I could go on and on about this, believe me. Because
don't get me started in that.
So I love it that you're able to practice like that, and you're doing such a good job. You do such a good job with the patients that we send to you. And thank you so much for everything you do and the person you are and what you've done for our military, our country. And you just are a great person, and I admire what you've done and still do.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it because I have a great admiration for what you do. I think you've been terrific, and I have been very blessed to know you.
Well, same here. I'm not on your level, but someday I'll probably never be on that level because of what you've done. But thank you. You're living a great life, and thank you all for listening. Dr. Brantner, I'm going to have you back on here again, and we'll just follow. We'll do one of these a year until we're both about, you know, 90, 100 years old, and then we'll play.
Sounds
more
good
golf.
To me.
Jim, thank you so much. Guys, we'll see you next week.